picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Judge us simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know that we've got to find. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. Ooh.
Right on. Right on.
Marvin Gaye. That song was released 50 years ago. That's from What's Going On. This is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice. We're on every Friday with rotating hosts. And I am pleased to be with you from 11:30 to 1. I have amazing people today to speak with you. And I'd like to start off with our first guest. He is Danny Schorzen. He's a retired U.S. Army officer, contributing editor at antiwar.com, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. His work has appeared throughout a gamut of media, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Nation, HuffPost, on and on, many publications. He's served combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and later taught history at West Point. He's the author of a memoir and critical analysis of the Iraq War called Ghost Riders of Baghdad, Soldiers, Civilians, and the Myth of the Surge, and Patriotic Dissent, America in the Age of Endless War. He's an author, speaker, podcaster, activist, and his professional website is skepticalvet.com, so you can follow him. Danny, welcome to the Peace and Justice program again. You were with us in December. I'm so happy you can make it back.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to do it. I really enjoyed our conversation last time, and as predicted, there's more than ever to talk about.
Yes, I know. I've been listening to you talking on different shows, some of your recorded work, and I'm just so thrilled to have you back. This last 4 years have been really difficult for us as Americans, and I was wondering, number one, about your take as a military veteran about Trump and wars and the past, his support of dictators, withdrawal from treaties, use of proxies, use of sanctions. Can you just kind of sum up the Trump regime?
Absolutely. You know, I think that most analyses of Trump, whether they come from various wings of the left or, you know, and I mean vague sense left, or from like the libertarian right or from the Republican establishment, they usually kind of err in two different directions, in my opinion. So there is a feeling among some people who are skeptical of Biden, and I include myself in that, that, well, actually, maybe Trump was almost a better option on foreign policy than Biden because, he didn't start any new wars, and he used this occasional, like, rhetorical only, anti-militarism or anti-war nature. But, in reality, yes, Trump didn't necessarily start any new wars, but, let's be clear, he absolutely escalated several conflicts. Somalia, until the very end when he pulled some troops out or started to, a massive increase in the bombing, a massive increased support for the Saudis and the Gulf state, stayed in pretty much all the wars until the very end when he sort of kind of, demonstrated in the direction of pulling out. His legacy is a lot more of the same than the establishment wings of either the Republican or Democratic Party want to admit. And his support for dictators is real. I mean, it's real, and it's something we have to talk about. And Democrats knew it as well, and I think we'll see some of the same from Biden, although maybe a little less overt and coarse. But, this is a president who said, caught saying this, here's my favorite dictator, when general coup artist, massacre of thousands of Egyptian protesters in the streets, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, walked into the room for a meeting. And of course, his first trip is to Saudi Arabia, and he does a sword dance with his hands on an orb in a bizarre moment that was fully in line with American foreign policy for quite some time. So, I think that the Trump foreign policy should not be nostalgized by people who are critical of Biden. I think that the critique of Biden's foreign policy team and record is important and needs to continue, and I've been one of the large proponents of it. I mean, I've been hammering these people. But I think that we should avoid thereby somehow sanctifying or nostalgizing or whitewashing some of Trump's record, which was generally obscene on foreign policy, except for the occasional rhetorical blast that I might have agreed with.
Yeah. I want to talk about Biden in a minute, but one of the other areas that I know most of us are concerned about is right-wing white supremacists, if I can say that. And one of the groups is called Oath Keepers, and they started in 2009 during the Obama administration as soon as he was sworn in. And they are current and former military, police, and first responders who say they're defending the Constitution, but actually have been in the leadership of this solidified right-wing extremist movement that we saw at its worst on January 6th. Can you talk about disinformation, conspiracy fabrication, racism, anti-Semitism, insular thinking among these people, and what we might do about it?
Well, certainly. I mean, you mentioned the Oath Keepers, which is one of several paramilitary sort of organizations. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting that are vaguely supportive of MAGA and the whole Trump thing. It's important, and it's not coincidental that they are founded, of course, formed after Obama's elected. And it is important to note that this one is specifically a veteran and police sort of infused organization. And of course, so many problematic organizations, they out their own contradictions in their own naming device, right, in their own title. Because if they were truly Oath Keepers, then they would understand that almost everything that they are supporting when it comes to the insurrection at the Capitol, riot, whatever you want to call it, is actually the opposite of that oath they're so interested in. Because, of course, the oath is not to a singular president, prioritized and foregrounded in the oath that military members take every time they reenlist or join, is I swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, not the president. Only after that do you mention, I'll follow the legal orders of my president as commander-in-chief. And yet they've chosen, in many cases, to hitch their star and really their lives to this singular demagogic figure of Trump, who has nothing to do with the Constitution. And so it's really ironic, but in a very dark way. The military has always had, historically speaking, I'm not just talking about post 9/11 or Trump era, historically speaking, the military has always been a haven, not the only haven, but it has always been a haven for a powerful and motivated minority, but a significant one within its ranks, that is white nationalist, that is paramilitary, that has buttressed sort of the hard right ideology around race or even semi-fascist. And so this is important to keep an eye on. It's problematic because these people are armed, these people are trained, these people are motivated, these people even have some, you know, leadership and charisma in many cases, which makes them dangerous. And it is no accident. Remember that Timothy McVeigh, who, besides 9/11, the bloodiest, right, single domestic terror incident was the Oklahoma City bombing, was himself a fairly decorated Gulf War veteran in the 1st Infantry Division at Fort Riley, where I commanded the troop that I took to Afghanistan. That is too easily forgotten.
God. You know, I think it must be really hard to train people to kill and then tell them to stop killing. I mean, I think that there's intrinsic in the military culture, all that training, it's got to go somewhere. I don't know. You probably agree from things I've heard you say.
Well, certainly, the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, forever wars, endless interventions militarily, and empire in a more general sense, right, however defined, historically and conceptually, they always come home. They always blow home. I mean, just study the British, study the French, study the Romans, right, all of the empires in history. When the legions come home, so to speak, using the Roman inflection, there's always blowback in the form of violence at home and these demobilized, technically but not demobilized, often in their own motivations and desires, these demobilized troops that hit the streets, I mean, some element of them, it's usually a vocal minority, but a vocal armed and motivated minority, do tend to cause significant problems. And we saw this with the rise of the KKK in the 1920s, and, you know, it is not, I mean, it bears mentioning that the height of the refounding of the KKK, you know, is like in 1919 or 1920, the second and more violent element of that KKK happens and reaches the zenith of its power in the decade and few years and decade that follows World War One. And there were a lot of World War One combat veterans in the organization, and so that should not totally surprise us.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, let's move to the inauguration and the people's mandate. You wrote about Dr. King's three evils of poverty, racism, and war, and then about capitalism underpinning militarism. This is the most important thing, I think, that we need to get at about how it's going to be pretty much business as usual. And can you talk about the link between capitalism and militarism and this $750 billion that could be so much better spent?
Well, you know, as I mentioned a few times recently, and then again on that panel I did with WBAI on Martin Luther King's Three Evils, mm-hmm. you know, when I was a kid, the Be All You Can Be snappy commercials with the snappy slogan for the Army, the recruiting commercials, you know, they were effective. And I think that if we're going to get the American people to care about our overseas wars, care about our military-industrial complex, then we have to connect it to kitchen-table issues and explain to them that, in reality, without being patronizing, explaining that there are real trade-offs and opportunity costs to spending when you add all the, you know, the side stuff in, about $1 trillion a year on defense, which is really not defense, but aggression. When you spend that, then you end up, you know, it takes away from other domestic programs at home, those kitchen table issues like healthcare, childcare, college. And so the Pentagon's slogan that we ought to be throwing around, banding about, and highlighting every time we get an opportunity is, you know, Department of Defense, colon, this is why you can't have nice things. And I think that there's a real truth to it, and we need to connect it. And Martin Luther King mentioned that the three evils were, of course, racism, which is what he's known for. It's the only thing we remember about him, even though he was far more radical and intersectional, as the kids say today, than all that, but also militarism, talking about how it was empire. It was an obscene intervention in the Vietnam War of his day that broke the back of the Great Society, that made sure that we couldn't have the social programs that LBJ had originally promised. And even LBJ came to realize that eventually, that, like, you know, the Great Society didn't die in Congress. The Great Society, which is these social programs, it died in Saigon. And he raises that, and all of which, he says, is underpinned by what he called excessive materialism, which is really the hyper-capitalism that we've seen go far more off the rails in, like, a neoliberal direction of mass income inequality. I think even Martin Luther King would be surprised how far through the looking glass we are, Alice, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, We go through time like it's money. Joe Biden is now officially at the helm of the U.S. war machine, and he's the fourth president you talk about to oversee America's unending and unsuccessful post 9/11 military campaigns. What will Biden's wars be like?
I think that what you'll see likely from Biden is something similar to the Obama years. This fantasy, this delusion that militarism and endless war in and of themselves are not the problem. It's how we're applying it. And so, you know, Joe Biden's people still believe, and he does, it appears, still believe in this notion of American exceptionalism, its indispensable nation status, and its mission to solve the world's problems. He still believes that, in the contrary to the evidence, that almost all of our military intervention since the Second World War has been wildly counterproductive. But he believes in this. And so what they seek is not all war to end, but Bush's wars to end or Trump's wars to end, wars that were helmed or thought up by folks on the other team, the red team. And so the mission has always been, the fantasy is the idea that they can create like a kinder, gentler, more tech savvy, lower cost, lower risk form of warfare that makes warfare an invisible abstraction to the American people, and therefore it can go on forever. So I think we'll see the use of proxies, air power, and special forces in place like the greater Middle East and Africa that will probably increase slightly under Biden. And I think that what we'll also see is a heightening of tensions precariously and riskily and recklessly so with Russia in particular, and then also perhaps with China.
Yeah, I'm most concerned about China for sure. I wanted to ask you about Biden appointees. Avril Haines was confirmed as Director of National Intelligence. She has a terrible record. And today, Lloyd Austin, Defense Secretary. Can you talk about those two, but also other ones that you've talked about that you're very concerned about? I know Jake Sullivan and Blinken for Secretary of State.
Well, certainly. I think that, okay, so let's start with Avril Haines. Right? She is confirmed by a vote of like maybe 81 to 19 or something, right? Bipartisan, in other words, in the Senate. So she will be the first woman to, you know, or the second woman now to, the first director of national intelligence is woman, but, you know, only the second head of like an intelligence agency like CIA because of Gina Haspel. But, and that sounds great, right? That sounds great, diversity. But actually, I think it's rather patronizing and paternalistic to say that we should all celebrate someone like Avril Haines being in charge because she's a woman, because that implies that there aren't any women who didn't help craft the system of drone assassination that Obama increased, that didn't support known torturer and known torture complicit Gina Haspel for Trump's CIA director, and who didn't ensure and approve the recommendation of a panel on, quote, you know, accountability at the CIA on torture after the Senate's torture report, which was made famous in that Amazon original, The Report. I mean, she was the person who basically said, yeah, we shouldn't punish anybody. There shouldn't be any, you know, ramifications for this massive torture program and all the people that are complicit in it, including the ones who spied on the Senate when they were trying to investigate them. So this is a problematic woman. And it's being fed to us as a victory for women, and it's being fed to us as a victory because it's not Trump's person. And then, of course, Lloyd Austin, who, let's assume that he's as good of a general and as good of a man as his reputation speaks to. Like, let's assume all of that. What we also know about him is that he requires a waiver because there is statute law that says you're not supposed to be in charge of the Department of Defense if you haven't been out of uniform for 7 years. That's an important component of civil primacy in the military. And then second, just like almost all the other people that Biden has picked and Trump picked, he is deeply embedded into the military-industrial complex, except in his case, he's dug in deeper than most because he worked directly for Raytheon, one of the great arms dealers in America. So in a sense, because he requires the waiver because he was a general not too long ago, and because he worked for Raytheon, here is a Secretary of Defense being put in charge by a supposedly liberal president who Lloyd Austin puts the military and the industrial into military-industrial complex.
Yeah. One of the people that you were speaking with on Inauguration Day called it the weaponization of identity politics. It's really unfortunate. What about the other two, Blinken and Jake Sullivan?
So, you know, Tony Blinken is a Biden guy. I mean, he's been with Biden for a very long time, since he was, you know, in the Senate. Blinken is a pretty standard liberal interventionist, pretty standard hawk in the Democratic establishment. He has said he doesn't want any accountability for Israel when they break international law repeatedly. He was one of the first people, or one of the strongest enthusiasts for arming Ukraine, for heightening the new Cold War with Russia. He gives speeches at various otherwise posturing as urbane defense industry funded think tanks, saying things like there still needs to be a strong military component to American intervention and policy in the Middle East. You know, and now he's the Secretary of State. It's like, okay, great, another chicken hawk, right? Another civilian hawk in charge of this Secretary of State, which is supposed to be about diplomacy. And then, you know, if we talk about Jake Sullivan is admittedly a bit of a blind spot for me. I mean, I study this guy more than anyone should for my sins. And look, he is my dark horse candidate for the most hawkish guy in the entire administration. And that's based on the fact that he was one of the more enthusiastic proponents for things like the regime change in Libya and the regime change that he wanted but didn't necessarily get in Syria, and that he has been an apologist and remains an apologist in many ways for the war crime, you know, masquerading as a war known as the Saudi terror war on Yemen. So, you know, he's one of the arsonists that's been put in charge of the fire brigade for American foreign policy. And, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, if a pyromaniac's in charge of the fire response when my house is burning, I'm not too excited.
No. No, you know, we have a few minutes left, and I just wanted to say this thing that I've had building up. My dad would have been 100 years old this year, and he was a history buff, like I know you are. You're actually a historian. He was very discouraged about the great men of history and seeing war as inevitable, which really discouraged him. Danny Shorzen, in your reading of history, do you have anything encouraging about either this period, 2021, and the Biden administration, or about the bigger picture of how we might disengage from militarism and crack this away from capitalism and reformat a positive experience for the people of the world so that we can survive?
You know, I usually do everything I can to avoid cliche or platitude, but I'm going to posit one that I believe. My hope is generally with the people, so to speak, which is not a popular thing to say at a time when so many of the people voted for Trump. Right? It's like there's a real disenchantment with like the people's will. Mm-hmm. But what I mean is, okay, so to start at the top really quick, I am encouraged by Biden on climate and by Biden on Iran, for example, getting back in the Iran deal. I don't think he's going to go far enough on either, but I think he is clearly, and we must speak with a clear voice here, he is preferable to Donald Trump on those two things, and they are important things, right? He believes climate change exists, so that makes me happy. So there are things about Biden that are preferable. But the real thing, the people, particularly the energized, some might call them the Bernie Sanders wing, whatever you want to call it, of the Democratic Party and some of their libertarian allies on foreign policy, which is to say that the Obama era saw a pretty significant, what I call the Obama dormancy, in like the anti-war movement and some of these more progressive elements of the party. They apologized for Obama because they liked him, and compared to Bush, he seemed like a pretty good guy. And while I'm seeing troubling signals about repeating that with Trump, you know, because like Biden's good because he's not Trump, and if you criticize Biden, you must like Trump. I run into this binary. I'm attacked regularly for this. But I think that overall, a lot of activists, a lot of folks on the vague left, progressive element of the Democratic Party, their eyes are more open this time. And I'm seeing some, not perfectly, but some positive signals that they're going to maintain pressure on Biden from day one or whatever it is, day, you know, three, whatever it is now. And any hope for decency on foreign policy from the Biden administration is going to come from an energized grassroots that pushes this eminently malleable man who's always run with the political wing, with the political winds. If we don't pressure him, we will not see positive outcomes. It will not come from the top. Salvation will not come from the top. It will come from the grassroots, or it will not come at all.
Mm-hmm. All right, well said. You know, Danny Shoresman, I wanted to have, if people want to, I would love it if you would tell them about your podcast, because I learn something every time I listen to you. Where can people find you?
Absolutely. So my podcast, co-hosted with a fellow vet, Henry Henriksen, is Fortress on a Hill, fortressonahill.com. And then my website, where all of my work ends up eventually, speaking and writing, is skepticalvet.com. And then give me a follow on Twitter. I put everything out there, a ton of stuff that I share, my own and others. And to keep it simple, that's at Skeptical Vet. So thanks for the opportunity to talk on the show and to plug some of that stuff.
Yeah, and you bet. And, you know, do you have any last words? I think for me, going back, talking about this anti-terrorism thing, I'm worried that that will be turned against the people. It will be turned against Black Lives Matter, as things always tend to do, against peaceful protests and our rights. Last word on that?
Absolutely. Look, I mean, I think that we don't learn from history. And what we found is that when tools of state repression and free speech violation are used against organizations and groups that we don't like, often for good reasons, we don't like them. That has always been eventually turned on dissidents, dissenters, and peaceful protesters on your own side. And so everyone should be very clear-eyed about that. And as Bernie said, you know, give a damn basically about someone you don't know. Well, care about the speech of people you don't agree with, because, you know, it will be, these tools of state repression will be turned on you. They always are, conceptually and historically speaking.
Thank you, Danny Shoresman, for being my guest today on the Peace and Justice Program. I really appreciate your work. Take care.
Thank you so much, and I'm always glad to do it.
All right, bye. All right, this is the Peace and Justice Program. I want to encourage you to listen to all of the public affairs programming here on KZFR, and of course, to our show every week. We are archived, and I will try to post that after the show if you want to go to the KZFR website and find that. And I'd like to thank our underwriters, because without you, generous KZFR supporters, and our underwriters, we wouldn't be able to make it, especially in these difficult times. So please support our underwriters, as they are all having a hard time too. So we are made possible by the generous contribution of Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And by Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980, Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available at the Thursday night market, which I hope will be back next summer, and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook. We're not quite to the top of the hour, but I want to thank some more underwriters for this next hour of the Peace and Justice Program here on your community radio station, KZFR. I'd like to thank local seasonal and organic offerings at Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. They have vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open 7 days a week for to-go lunch and dinner orders. Find Farmstar Pizza at 2359 Esplanade, at farmstarpizza.com, and on Facebook. The telephone number to order is 343-2056. And also, our own dear Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. And if you like this show, you can go to the kzfr.org website and tip the show, which helps the station, not the show. And I'd like to go on with our next guest here in a minute. But first, I'd like to let you know that it is noon, and this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until We learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Think of all the weapons we make around the world. Investing brains and money in the best ways how to kill. If we could use that money for the betterment of man and care about each other, there'd be peace throughout the land. War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Think of all the children who suffer due to war. Think of all the families together, nevermore. Think of all the soldiers who lost both life and limb. Oh, when we fight the battles, no one ever wins. War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will.
All right, Pat Scanlon, Extremist for Peace. And I have on the line with me an incredible woman, Rivera Sun. She is a change maker, a cultural creative, a protest novelist, and an advocate for nonviolence and social justice. She's the author of The Dandelion Insurrection, The Way Between, and other novels. She is the editor of Nonviolence News. Her study guide to making change with nonviolent action is used by activist groups across the country. She also facilitates workshops in strategy for nonviolent change across the country and internationally. Between 2012 and 2017, she was also a radio host, co-hosting national two syndicated radio programs on civil resistance strategies and campaigns. Her essays and writings are syndicated by Peace Voice and have appeared in journals nationwide. She is an advisory member of board member of World Beyond War and also of the Backbone Campaign. And welcome, Rivera Sun, to the Peace and Justice Program today.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, I always like to think of you there in your Earth house and outside of Taos, New Mexico, another world.
It's yeah, true.
Yeah, you are somebody who knows Erica Chenoweth well. She's a social justice campaign researcher. She's a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. And I was driving home from a demonstration at Beale Air Force Base the other night, and she was on alternative radio here on our listener-supported KZFR program. And she was talking about nonviolent resistance, civil resistance, up until January 2020. And her conclusions were that the last decade has been the most tumultuous on record, but she still found that 50% of nonviolent campaigns succeeded, while only 20% of violent campaigns succeeded. So she also said nonviolence is increasing in frequency, but decreasing in success. Can you kind of tease out for us some of the successes of nonviolence, and then also why is it less successful now?
Yeah, the work that Erica Chenoweth and also Maria J. Stephan and a kind of a team of researchers are doing right now in looking at civil resistance is truly groundbreaking. We've never had any kind of research of this scale and volume and caliber, looking at quantifiable data versus anecdotal tales. So it's a really significant thing that's happening. And, you know, one of the things about the noticing the decrease in success of nonviolent campaigns is to also, and Erica will talk about this, also note that there's a decrease in success of violent campaigns as well. So whether people are working for change with violence or nonviolence, they're having a little more difficulty right now achieving that. And there's a lot of reasons that could be. One of the ones that we know about is that the people on the other side are getting more skilled in how to break up movements, how to repress them, how to diffuse them, how to get rid of them, basically. So it's important to understand that we're not working in a vacuum. The other side is also learning, and we know dictators in particular around the world actually talk to each other about how to stop uprisings against them. So I think that's, you know, something our movements can think of, is that we also need to be learning the best practices from one another and not reinventing wheels, and maybe really trying to study this remarkable field that we're a part of.
Yeah. And I read an article that she wrote this morning about that Black Lives Matter protests had very little violence in them, but that news media, how they framed it, really mattered, and that public perceptions actually had an effect in the election and on public policy. And then she said authoritarian leaders try to delegitimize and criminalize protest. And so how important is the media in all of this, and the social media?
I would say it plays a significant role in nonviolent campaigns. You're always trying to sway people into either supporting your movement, actively participating in it, or at least not actively working against you. And of course, all media plays a big role in how they view what you're doing. It also plays a role in justifying the use of various forms of repression to stop your movement in the eyes of those who want to stop you. So, you know, that it is significant. And I think new studies have also shown that leftist movements are repressed four times as much with greater use of force than movements on the right. So there's a disparity right there, right off the bat. This is in the U.S., in terms of how we are responded to by police and by other forms of repression. But, you know, Chris, one thing I think I need to mention about why movements are not succeeding as frequently as they did in, say, the previous decades, is one of the reasons is that in this age of social media and mass media, we're seeing the images of mass protests a lot. And what this does is it triggers a mimicry effect, right? So we see one nation rising up with mass protests, and we all go out into the street to protest our regime that we don't like. But the thing is, we don't see the images of the strikes and the boycotts that may be preceding those mass demonstrations. So without those forms of tangible economic and social non-cooperation, where we actively remove our consent and cooperation, our resources and our time from supporting business as usual, our protests may be vulnerable to this kind of repression that we've been talking about, and they may lose steam, right? So we want to make sure we're pairing tactics, and I think if we look at successful movements around the world, we see that pairing of mass demonstration with acts of non-cooperation.
Yeah, and you always talk about strategy, and Erica Chenoweth was talking about discipline, and I know that you studied with Reverend Lawson, and that was something that he really stressed. Can you talk a little bit more about how we win in terms of a social movement?
Yeah, so one of the things that Erica and Maria also found in their groundbreaking study, Why Civil Resistance Works, is that the first determining factor of what makes a movement successful is actually participation, and not just any participation, not just holding signs, but removing your tangible cooperation and consent from the power holders that you're trying to influence. So going on strike, boycotting, occupations, blockades, things like that. But then the second most important factor determining the success of a movement was repression and weight, not the amount of repression used by your opponents, but rather what you do when repression hits you. So if you maintain nonviolent discipline, if you vary your tactics, right, so if you, instead of going out with demonstrations where you're going to get into street fights with the police, you decide to empty the street instead and maintain that nonviolent commitment, you are much more likely to succeed in achieving your goals. And in 2019, we saw a tremendous case study in this in Sudan when a women-led movement rose up against the 29-year-long dictator. And they withstood a massacre of 100 of their demonstrators. And the way that they did that is, in the wake of that tragedy, instead of going back into the streets where another tragedy might have unfolded, they emptied the streets entirely. They called for a a national strike. Everyone stayed home. And this allowed them to keep going with their campaign, even in the midst of horrible repression, maintaining that nonviolent discipline. And they indeed did oust their dictator, and they stopped the military from taking complete control over the country, and are now in a process of ensuring a full transition to a civilian government.
Mm-hmm. So we have just gotten through a repressive period. It could have gotten worse if Trump had been reelected, so thank God he wasn't. But I want to ask you about the inauguration and Biden's administration in terms of the things that must be changed, the climate change we need, the end of this persistent racism and voter suppression, and then the whole nuclear issue and militarism that takes food out of the mouths of people. How do you feel like in an administration that seems more open and positive, how can we move forward with the same fervor and the same commitment and organizational structures?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's a good one for us all to contemplate. One thing I'm happy to report is that it does appear to me that the social movements have learned from some of the pitfalls that we experienced under the Obama and Biden administration in the previous cycle. And we learned that we can't sit back, right? If we want real substantial change, we have to keep pushing for it. We can't just assume that somebody who looks slightly more favorably towards us will go above and beyond the least possible change that they can make, get away with making, right? So I'm seeing movements like Sunrise Movement, certainly Black Lives Matter, the movements for economic justice, housing justice is a big campaign, pushing and pushing and pushing. They're not asleep. There's no honeymoon period. Every time a small victory is achieved, they're right on top of it right now and saying, good job, Biden administration. Now what we need you to do is X, Y, Z. Build on this legacy and keep going. Don't say that's enough. And a good example of this is, you know, Biden just rejected the permit for the KXL pipeline, which has been a 10-year-long major civil resistance struggle to stop that oil pipeline. And organizers aren't sitting back. They're saying, all right, now we need you to fully reverse the DAPL pipeline that was the cause of the Standing Rock protests. We need you to stop Enbridge Line 3 and Line 5, which have both have resistance campaigns going on right now. And we need you to just keep going because we don't have time to delay on the climate front.
Yeah.
So I think it's that kind of yes and, thank you and keep going, that is going to be a really powerful strategy for our movements in the coming years.
Yeah, that sense of immediacy is really important and energy. Rivera-san, I wanted to ask you about your own work, starting with Nonviolence News. I am absolutely amazed that you are posting 30 to 50 stories of nonviolence in action around the world every single week in this Nonviolence News. Tell us about how you got that started and what's the purpose. And I'm wondering how to get, I mean, when people are busy, it's hard to take this all in, but so much is happening around the world, and it's so positive.
You know, I'm glad you said that about if people are busy, it's hard to take it in. I have that problem, right? So one of the things I decided to do was to go through about 100 e-newsletters a week and pick out the stories that are really anchored in this kind of civil resistance and nonviolent action that we're talking about. Not just the stories of what's wrong with the world, not just our critiques or even just our suggestions of what should be better, but rather who are the people using things like boycotts, strikes, occupations, blockades, demonstrations, civil disobedience to make the changes that we need to see. And I thought maybe I'd find 10 stories a week, honestly, Chris. But what I discovered was that 30 to 50 is what I've found for almost 2 years now. And I can't even keep up with it all. But what I do is I round it up into one easy-to-read newsletter that you can literally scan the headlines of once a week on Saturdays when it comes out. And that way you get this, like, feeling of how powerful these movements are, how many of us are out there making change, what the best tactics are that are popping up. I always put in a few pictures because, you know, they're worth a thousand words. And seeing the faces of farm workers who are rising up for their rights, or hospital nurses who are walking out on strike to make sure they get hazard pay, or Tunisians who are, well, the Tunisian is an interesting example. I'll go into that later on because they've had some struggles with discipline. But Chileans who got their new constitution this past year with largely women-led actions. So seeing the faces of people like us who are making change is incredibly powerful. And, you know, if people want to see this, they should go to nonviolencenews.org and just scan the homepage. You'll find these wonderful roundups there, nonviolencenews.org, no dashes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And sometimes you have had groups gather and to talk about the news, and that's another pretty stimulating thing, because just like a book club, it makes you read everything. And I appreciated that. I'd like to turn to your books, because you are such a prolific writer. I'm just amazed at everything you're getting done in this world, but you're also a nonviolence trainer, and I know you have things even this week, but you've recently completed the Dandelion Trilogy with a book called Winds of Change, which I wasn't able to read yet, but I'm planning to, and it, I think in the novel form, it allows your mind to really stretch to the possible. Can you talk about your motivation for writing the Dandelion Trilogy, and I don't want to give anything away, but I'm really eager to find out how the good guys win.
Well, you know, I think that's one reason why we love fiction, is we do need that feeling of the good guys win, especially when we're in the slog of feeling like we're not winning, right? So in 2012, I set out to write a novel that celebrated the very stories we've been talking about today on the show, where they use nonviolent action to challenge and transform the situation of being stuck under a corporate dictatorship, what they call it, in a fictionalized United States. So it's somewhat familiar to us. It does deal with some of the issues we're facing, but they name one of the problems in a slightly different way than we're used to, and they go about changing that and challenging that and dealing with what happens when a regime, like a hidden corporate dictatorship, tries to preserve its power. And so the first book, The Dandelion Insurrection, deals with ousting that regime, and the second book, The Roots of Resistance, deals with defending their gains against, you know, a character who's very much like this moment that we find ourselves in with Biden, where we feel like he's pretty friendly to some of our goals, but we also don't want to get in a situation where 2 years in, no change has been made, or even that some of our changes have been unraveled. So that's what the second book is about. But the third book, Winds of Change, goes even further, and it says, what is democracy really? Beyond just the representative system, what does it mean when we, the people, are involved in making the decisions over the things that shape the content of our lives? And if we build up a movement for that in our schools, in our workplaces, in our companies, our businesses, and where we shop, and how we organize our housing, even our politics, especially our politics, what happens when the status quo fights back, right? And how do we as citizens make sure that democracy and the solutions that people are bringing forward have a chance to be expressed and hopefully even enacted.
Mm. We're talking to Rivera Sun. She is telling us about her books, and her website is Rivera Sun, one word, sun.com, and you're listening to KZFR Community Radio. Rivera, I wanted to ask you about the other, there's four books in the Ari Ara group, and this is for young adults, and it confronts prejudice, discrimination, bullying, violence, and injustice with everything action and adventure, but also magic and fantasy, so more aimed at young adults. Can you tell us about those books? Because I think they're so great for young adults.
I mean, thanks, Chris. Glad you think so.
Preteens, yeah.
Yeah, so after the Dandelion Insurrection started getting out and about, people started asking me if it was appropriate for younger children. And it can be read by, you know, teens, certainly, and maybe even a mature preteen. But I really felt like the genre of young adult fantasy has a big glaring hole. I mean, it's getting more and more inventive by the year, more and more inclusive by the year. But it also isn't challenging violence and war as a primary method of, let's say, conflict navigation in the plot. And we know that promoting violence creates more violence in our world, and we know that we don't just ride off into the sunset after that happens, whether that means we're struggling with PTSD or we're dealing with the aftermath of a violent incident in our community. It really doesn't play out like the fantasy shows it, right? So I set out to tell a high fantasy adventure story of a young girl, but to replace what we usually use violent plots for with nonviolent plot twists. So what if instead of winning a war, the main character stops a war? What if instead of a duel, the main character ends up organizing a boycott? And if you look around at today's teens, they are one of the most highly politically active generations in the U.S., maybe ever. And so these are story motifs and narratives that directly relate to their lives, whether they're walking out of school to stop gun violence, or they're standing up for climate justice or racial justice. There's just so many ways they're using these tools. So the Ariara series has 4 books in it right now, but it will ultimately have 7 or maybe 8 books. And each one tells a different, marvelously fun, in my opinion, story about a fantasy world where nonviolence is not the norm, but it's certainly introduced into the scene where war and violence would otherwise have a central role.
And that's called Ariara, which is not this, not that. Is that correct? That's her name.
Right. So she's a multi-ethnic child born of 2 different peoples who have historically been at war. And in this body of hers, she really deals with a lot of the discriminations that come up when violence is our primary mode of conflict resolution.
So, you know, this has been the year of good trouble, and we've lost some significant people in this last year who were the keys to the civil rights movement. That generation is dying off, and we find ourselves carrying Dr. King's legacy forward in the many different ways it is. Some people whitewash him, others are now discovering how radical and truth-telling he really was. In terms of going forward, I was wondering, for you, as an activist and as somebody who is so deeply ingrained in nonviolence, where will you go next in your writing and energy, looking at the culture and time you're embedded in?
That's a great question. We're really up to the deadline on the climate crisis. We really need to see dramatic change in the next 5 to 10 years, top. Or we're simply not going to have a livable planet. So that's a big focus for me and for a lot of people, and making sure that we really understand how to use these tools of nonviolent action powerfully and strategically is going to be key to meeting the demands of the climate crisis in that period. I think in my writing, I'm also more and more curious about the work of peace teams and the ways that ordinary people can de-escalate violence as it may be starting to arise right in front of our eyes. I'm interested in the work of peace building. So beyond just nonviolent campaigns for change, how do we reach out to those people that we may disagree with, we may be afraid of, we may be in conflict with, and find ways to de-escalate our conflicts from the point of violence? And I think this is really important for our culture right now, because we have a lot of substantial divisions in our country. And if we only use violence as a way of solving those, our might makes right mentality, we are going to be very unhappy in this process. But fortunately, there's a lot of other tools out there for us to use. And I think if we got proactive and invited people to the table, to being part of the solution, to acknowledging where they may have a just grievance that our side of the equation is not dealing with, I think we could diffuse a lot of the tensions that are building to the point of violence, and also maybe open up some very interesting creative problem-solving collectively. So those are some themes that I'm thinking more and more about, but I also know that personally I'm continuing my commitment to being involved in movements of change because I think we are at a very critical juncture. And, you know, as for Dr. King's legacy, as you mentioned, I have a friend, Kazu Haga, who many people are reading his book right now, Healing Resistance. And in it, he asks this provocative question of, when the going gets tough, what if we escalated our compassion and our principled nonviolence at the same rate as our escalation of tactics? So if we're escalating from simply a petition to marches to boycotts and strikes, how do we also escalate our empathy and compassion, our quest for a greater understanding, at the same time as those tactics? Because really, we can't allow injustice to continue. But we also need to understand that simply shouting at another person or using nonviolent action to get our way isn't going to get at the underlying problem that gave rise to the conflict in the first place. So we've got to stop the harm and reach even deeper to really get at the root causes of why we have so many conflicts.
Hmm. Thank you, Rivera-san, for your work and for all of the things that you're doing right now. And I do hope that people will check out some of the organizations that you're involved with, World Beyond War, and I don't even know what Backbone Campaign is, but I'll check it out too. And your website, again, is riverasun.com, and people can order your books there. Anything else you want to say, Rivera, before I leave you?
Oh, just that I appreciate you getting on the airwaves and spreading the word about the things people need to know about that maybe aren't necessarily hitting the mass media all the time. So thank you so much for that, Chris, and for continuing the work of peace and justice.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And please take care, okay?
I will.
All right. Bye. All right. We're on the Peace and Justice program here. I will be hosting again next week, and I would like to give you a whole hour of Erica Chenoweth, who is that Professor Kennedy School social justice researcher that I spoke about earlier, and because I think her work is so important. If we're going to have the kind of change that we need in the world, we have to learn how to do it. And let's see, you know, in terms of what Rivera was saying, I didn't even bring any announcements today, but, you know, our situation in Chico is dire with the unhoused people. It's going to get into the sub-freezing temperatures and in the rain starting tonight. And the city has given eviction notices to people that are in two different areas now. They have no place to go. There's no plan. And if you ever wanted to get hold of your city council members, this would be the time. Do what you can actually also for those people in terms of material aid, or if you know a place where they can go, or, you know, anything that you can do, and joining the people that are already doing the work, the people that feed people on Sundays and give out socks and warm things and tarps and everything. Please jump in wherever you can, because we have a human rights crisis just in our own community. And so we're going to go on to our next guest, our last guest, and please stay tuned. I'm going to give you a little Michael Franti to bridge the gap here.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation, and the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, there is no other choice.
God bless the people now who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa. Flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses. Stand up if you're still sane.
Stand up if you're still sane. Okay, so that Michael Franti song really spoke to the moment. I am very, very pleased to bring you Ray Atchison from New York City. Ray is an activist and writer working to abolish violent structures and build peace and justice. They lead the disarmament program at Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, the world's oldest feminist peace organization. They serve on the steering group of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, we'll call that ICAN, which won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize for its work to ban nuclear weapons, as well as the steering committees of the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots and the International Network on Explosive Weapons. Ray is also author of many papers and articles challenging weapons, militarism, and war from an intersectional feminist perspective. They have written authored a book most recently about the global quest to prohibit nuclear weapons called Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, which will be released later this spring. And I am really looking forward to that book. They are currently a visiting research collaborator at Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security. And welcome to the Peace and Justice Program, Ray Atchison.
Thank you so much for having me.
We could spend half the time me reading more stuff about you, but I'd like to get into the incredible content that we have today. One thing I wanted to ask you first, though, is in your book, Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, you talk about we have so much at stake, from climate change, reproductive rights, threats from weapons of mass destruction to police brutality. And the last decade has seen ordinary people take to the streets to challenge and change the way our governments and institutions legislate our futures. Movements like Black Lives Matter and Me Too have had an incredible impact on public understandings and political commitments, showing that meaningful change of social movements and popular resistance can have on our world. And so I wanted to ask you, how did you get involved in this? How could you prioritize abolition from nuclear weapons as worth your time, as important as all these other struggles that are going on?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. Well, I think it's also important to note that I do support the abolition of other structures of violence as well. So abolition of police and prisons is something that I'm in particular concerned about. But my focus on nuclear weapons is really because I see these as part of the leading edge of the structure of violence that challenges all of us and all of our lives. I see nuclear weapons as being intimately bound up with the militarist, capitalist, racist, patriarchal system that is oppressing so many of us from so many different angles. You can look at the money that's wasted on nuclear weapons. We're talking about billions of dollars every year. In 2021, the U.S. is currently prepared to spend over $50 billion just in 1 year on nuclear weapon modernization. So this is about, you know, upgrading the arsenal and building new types of weapons. So we can see how invested we are in these weapon systems that are really all about violence. They're weapons that are built for genocide. They're weapons that are built to destroy entire cities, like we saw with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A single bomb can take out an entire city and kill hundreds of thousands of people. So I see nuclear weapons as part of a bigger system of violence, and they're a particularly violent part of that system.
And you're so, it's so timely that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons goes into effect now at the beginning of the Biden administration, because I know that it was Obama who started the modernization program and started a new arms race. So congratulations on your work for this Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Can you, before we talk about the treaty itself, can you go a little more into the current nuclear threat that humanity is living under?
Yes, absolutely. You are entirely correct that the Obama administration started the current modernization program, and we expect that to be continuing under the Biden administration, though, of course, we will be putting pressure on the government to stop that. There are currently just over 13,000 nuclear weapons in the world today. 90% of those belong to the United States and Russia. And then there are seven other countries that possess nuclear weapons currently. So that's China, France, the United Kingdom, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea also has a few nuclear weapons. But I think it's important to recognize that while we're talking about the most militarized countries in the world that are investing billions of dollars into these weapons, we're also only talking about nine countries. Right? This isn't, this global problem really comes down to a handful of bullies dictating to us the way that we have to live under the threat of nuclear war all of the time.
Right. And, you know, on the mainstream news today, they did mention the START II treaty that will be renegotiated with Russia. They've mentioned also the Iran nuclear deal that Biden intends to get back involved in those things. But even though they're important, the United States has never complied with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And why are these other treaties just not enough?
Well, those are both important instruments, the one that you mentioned, the New START and the Iran deal, and absolutely essential that the United States recommit to those. But they are about arms control, and they are about non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. And the non-proliferation treaty itself has had that at its core, preventing the spread of nuclear weapons to other countries, which is, of course, very important. But under the non-proliferation agreement, the United States also committed to nuclear disarmament, and it has not complied with that, as you said. And that treaty has been in force since 1970. So it's not like they haven't had time to engage with their legal obligations for nuclear disarmament, which the nuclear armed states are bound to. And so we've needed a new treaty and a new mobilization for the total prohibition of nuclear weapons, to outlaw not just the proliferation or the spread of nuclear weapons, but to outlaw the weapons themselves and their possession for all countries.
Yeah, and I'd like a little of the backstory about who and how was the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons initiated, and who are the partners in this work that you've now had come to fruition?
The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, it was founded in 2007 in Australia, and it was actually started by the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, which is a medical association of doctors and nurses who are opposed to nuclear weapons. And they've been around for decades trying to prevent a nuclear arms race originally between the United States and the Soviet Union all those years ago. And so they've been doing this work for a long time, but they started ICAN to remobilize a younger generation of activists against the bomb. And from its founding in Australia, it's spread around the world so that we now comprise over 500 organizations in well over 100 countries. So it's truly a transnational activist network that is active in all corners of the world.
Yeah, it's so wonderful and astounding. And Over time, you've gotten all these co-sponsors so that it has gone into effect today. And can you talk a little bit about the campaign and who supports the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons?
Yeah, so the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons has been working specifically for this treaty now for well over a decade. It really was a conversation that started between some ICANN activists and some diplomats and a few others at a global nuclear weapons meeting that was just once again another talk shop. This was, you know, back in 2010 or even earlier, just frustrated with the stagnation around nuclear disarmament, frustrated with the rhetoric that the Obama administration had put out early on, saying that it wanted to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons, and then turning around and announcing this new modernization program worth billions of dollars. And so it started like that, just a conversation of what we can do as non-nuclear armed states, as activists, as folks working for humanitarian agencies that would have to deal with nuclear weapons if they were ever used. And what is it that we can do, even if the nuclear armed states refuse to get on board or support our efforts? And we looked at the lessons learned from banning landmines and cluster bombs, which had come in the years before. Mm-hmm. And these were treaties that were developed initially without the support of the producers and users of these weapons. It was led by countries where these weapons were being used and killing civilians and creating havoc on economic development and the environment. And so it really came from survivors and from affected countries rather than the militarized countries that were using these weapons. And we thought we could do something like that on nuclear weapons. Of course, we were told, no, you can't. Nuclear weapons are completely different. You can't do that. But we did do it. It took many, many years. It took efforts to build up a community of actors among diplomats and government officials of non-nuclear armed countries, working together with ICANN and academics and the International Committee for the Red Cross and other agencies like that who were very concerned with nuclear weapons. And over years, we built up a community of actors, people who were committed to this issue, to bring this idea into the United Nations and negotiate a treaty that would prohibit these weapons.
And you're listening to Rae Acheson. She's the director of Reaching Critical Will, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and on the steering group of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons here on the Peace and Justice Show on KZFR. So what does the treaty actually call for, Rae?
The treaty prohibits all nuclear weapon activities. So it outlaws possession, deployment, development, use, threat of use, and it also prohibits assistance with any of these acts. So what this means is that if you are investing money in nuclear weapon producers, that is not allowed. If you are allowing nuclear weapons to transit through your territories, that is not allowed. If you have nuclear weapons, of course, that is not allowed. Now, of course, these prohibitions are only binding on the countries that ratify it. So they have to undertake a domestic process to ratify this treaty and to say that it is part of their national law. And currently, we have 52 countries that have done that. When we've reached 50, that's what triggered the entry into force, which is why that is happening today on January 22nd. So we have that. More will be coming on board as the months go on. That process has not stopped. But the treaty also has normative effects even on the countries that haven't ratified it. So even though under international law it's only binding on its parties, it will have impacts on the behavior and the policies of other countries that don't currently support it.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you next, is about, since the treaty has no real teeth, how will it work to abolish nuclear weapons? You say it's a normative effect. What does that mean?
So, yes, right now, while the nine nuclear armed states have said they refuse to join this treaty, and there's a few other countries that say that they support U.S. nuclear weapons and they won't join the treaty, allies of the U.S. have said this, including my country, Canada. there's going to be a stigmatizing effect that's already underway around concepts like nuclear deterrence, around the deployment of nuclear weapons, around possible use of nuclear weapons, and against their very possession. And so we've seen this happen, for example, with the Landmine Treaty and Cluster Bomb Treaty that I talked about earlier. Both of those instruments have not been signed onto by the United States, and yet the U.S. actually complies with many of the provisions of these treaties. Mm. It doesn't use landmines anymore, except in the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea, but in conflicts around the world, the United States doesn't use the weapons. The last producer of cluster munitions in the United States stopped a few years ago, and it said there was no more economic incentive for it to do so because of the Convention on Cluster Munitions basically shut down the need or the demand for the production of these weapons. And so with nuclear weapons and with this treaty, what we're already seeing is financial institutions, banks, and pension funds have already started to withdraw money from the nuclear weapon producers and have declared policies that they won't invest in these weapons anymore because they're outlawed under international law. And it's quite interesting. You would think if you had an ethical investment fund, why weren't you already divested from nuclear weapons? But there is something about the normative impact of international law that's very meaningful for institutions like this. It's now the letter of the law that these are prohibited weapons. And so we're going to see the economic impact over time. And that's something that everybody can actually get involved in doing. You can call up your own bank and see if they are invested in nuclear weapons or have a policy about it. We have an initiative called don'tbankonthebomb.com where you can go to find out to see if your bank's investing and get some tools for moving your own money. But there's going to be all kinds of these things that are happening. We're seeing already in cities across the U.S. and across the other nuclear armed states that are saying at the city council level or declarations from mayors that they support the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and want the federal government to join. San Francisco just joined that today. We also have Washington, D.C. on there. New York City has legislation that it is considering right now to divest from nuclear weapons. So there's all kinds of actions and momentum building around the world in support of this treaty that can have an impact on government policy over time.
Well, we tried to join you in Chico. We just weren't successful, but maybe in the future we will. But I wanted to know about pushback from the nuclear-armed states around the world. How are they lining up against this treaty?
They put in a very big effort to try and prevent this treaty from ever happening. The United States, France, and United Kingdom in particular were very aggressive in trying to prevent the negotiations from even happening. They put a lot of pressure on countries to not support the resolution in the General Assembly, the UN General Assembly, to start negotiations. Then they tried to get their allies to not participate, to actually boycott the negotiations. And then they've tried to get countries to not sign and ratify the treaty. And the former U.S. administration did an unprecedented thing in which it sent a letter to all the countries that had ratified the treaty saying that they had made a mistake and they should unratify it. So this is something we had never seen before in international diplomacy or treaty making, where a government would call on other sovereign states to withdraw from a treaty. And it's so interesting because, you know, if the nuclear armed states believe that this treaty is so going to be so ineffective, which is what they say, that it won't result in the elimination of a single of their nuclear weapons and it will never impact their policies. If that's true, then why are they so scared of this treaty?
Yeah, exactly. I'm very excited about this. I hope people can tell what a big deal this is, because I know there's celebrations going on all over the world. Can you tell us about those?
There are hundreds and hundreds of events happening all over the world today. It's just been really incredible. And, you know, the treaty entered into force when the clock struck midnight for each country. And so celebrations started what was last night for us. So I've been online basically since last night watching it come into force around the world. There's been actions in the street where that has been possible, not everywhere that's been possible, of course. There's been so much online activity. In the United States, there have been dozens of activities actually at nuclear weapons sites around the country, which is really inspiring to see people getting out with their masks and being social distant, but bringing the awareness of the treaty right to the doorstep of the nuclear weapon complex in this country. And we've also seen celebrations from the governments that supported this treaty. You know, this isn't just an act of a celebration. This is a real moment of reckoning for so many countries in the world that were told that they weren't important enough to have a voice on this issue, that they couldn't have a say, that they weren't credible, that they didn't have real security interests, and all of these very patriarchal and very racist condemnations of these countries for standing up to power and saying that no, nuclear weapons are immoral and must be eliminated and must be prohibited. And so seeing those governments and countries celebrate around the world today has just been really incredible.
Yeah. Oh, I can see it in my mind's eye. And so in terms of our role, you talked about it a little bit, but the reality is that nuclear weapons and climate change are the two things that can destroy the biological life on the planet as we've known it. And what is our role? I mean, how deep should we dig? What should we really be doing?
Yeah, you've exactly hit it on the head. These are the sort of related, interrelated crises that we face. And of course, there's so much other violence in the world that we're confronting on a day in our daily lives. And so certainly as an anti-nuclear activist, I don't ever want to suggest that people need to drop everything and focus on this one issue. But what I do want people to think about is the ways in which nuclear weapons impact their lives or the other things that they're active on without even maybe realizing it, because there's so many insidious ways, like I was saying in the very beginning, about how nuclear weapons impact our world and how they've really shaped our world. And this sort of cult of nuclearism, as some of us call it, this belief in the power of nuclear weapons to protect us and to provide us with security, when in reality, they are one of the most existential threats that we face, that we still face today, even though, you know, the awareness of the Cold War era has dissipated, but the threat has remained the same, and with the challenges that we face in the world is even growing right now. So I think that's something really important for people to hold on to and to think through, is how do nuclear weapons affect my life? What are the things that I'm active on in terms of social justice and climate change and environmental preservation? How does that relate to anti-nuclear activism? And are there ways that we can connect up and support each other's movements? What are the structures, the economic structures, the political structures that we all have in common in our movements for social justice and for change in the world? Where can we make those connections? Are they here in our own cities? Are they on the other side of the planet? How do we build those communities? And I think with that kind of building and connecting really comes a sense that we can make change if we are working together. And I think that we've seen that recently with the U.S., with the protests that have happened over the last few months against police brutality and violence against Black lives, in years past, different challenges around LGBTQ issues, women's rights issues, trans rights issues, sexual violence, gender-based violence, etc. Everything that we confront, all of these issues that we care passionately about and that affect people's lives in a daily way, they all require us to build up a community to challenge it together. And I think that's the most important thing to hold going forward from this day of celebration.
And, you know, while you were speaking, we have time for one more minute. And I was thinking about the United Nations, and the United Nations was a through line after World War II, a sort of a never again moment after what was done to Japan with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and their very first act was to have a statement about nuclear weapons. And so there's a through line to the past. Can you just address that briefly about how this goes back to our ancestors?
Absolutely, yes. In 1945, when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was an international condemnation of that. And the International Red Cross said in that moment that they could not cope with this disaster, and that was two bombs dropped on two cities. The United Nations, in its very first resolution after it was established, agreed to outlaw nuclear weapons, and it's taken this long to do it, and the nuclear armed states still oppose it. And they're on the wrong side of history, and our ancestors and everyone that we can learn from that's come before us, they've been on the right side of history, and I hope that this treaty can help propel us forward a little more today.
Thank you, Ray Atchison, for being with us today on the Peace and Justice Program. You can read Ray's work. There's much to be learned here. It's rayatchison.com or reachingcriticalwill.org, and her organization, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Talk about ancestors, the oldest peace group in the United States, I believe, WILPF.org. Thank you so much for being with us today, Ray Atchison, and get the rest you need when you finally come down off that wonderful cloud.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so this treaty wasn't even mentioned today anywhere in the news that I heard, except one thing in the headline on Democracy Now! So that is another reason to support community radio. You would not have heard this anywhere else, this amazing thing that's happening all around the world today, the prohibition of nuclear weapons, and doesn't get any better than that. So I want to thank all the listeners and supporters for KZFR, as well as our underwriters here. I want you to stay tuned for Playing Dead, please. They have a great show for you today. And I want to thank our generous supporters and Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit chicocourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. And the virtual open studios, I'm going to say that again. Hang on, let me put my mask on here. We're having a transition. The virtual Chico Open Studio Arts Tour, where you can attend the art tour of Northern California artists every day. There are over 50 artist pages featuring art, videos, and information about each artist and how to purchase artwork. To obtain the access code, visit chicoosat.com and support artists and Chico Art Center from home. Details also on Facebook and at chicoartcenter.com. So once again, peace to all of you. I'm going to go straight here to the community calendar and wear your mask, okay? Peace.
Hey listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The Farmers Market Mobile is coming to Megalia. Every Thursday from 11 to 2